Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Sheikh. You guys, I know 8 p.m. is late, so thank you so much for sticking around and tuning in. I appreciate it very, very much. I know the Biden debate, town hall is happening, and I'm actually very happy that Biden chose to do his town hall in Pennsylvania, and of course Trump is in South Florida, and you know, those are just two very different town hall meetings. One is an absolute disaster, which we know which one it is. It's Trumpy's, and Biden's is just so much more calmer, composed, presidential, you know. I know we're not gonna get too political right now because I have a guest tuning in today. All the way from Dubai, you guys. Yes, I'm expanding my horizons as far as my international guests go. So I am waiting for him to tune in shortly, which he would be, which I'm very excited about. This person is really a trailblazer. This person's a, you know, Canadian hip hop musician, and really built out their career in songwriting, and had the opportunity to work with some really big people early on in their career. And now are moving on to, have moved on to, my goodness, come up founder and CEO of a publishing company, music publishing company in Dubai. And he's going to be tuning in shortly. But I wanted to actually ask you guys, let's see here. James said, good evening, everybody. Hello, James. How are you? And then Tim said, hey, James. And Tim said, hey, Mona, I can't make the show. I have to go to work in 4 hours. Damn it, Tim. No, don't go to work. Stay. Don't go. You guys, I do have a really cool announcement to make today. I just got offered yesterday to be a host of a fabulous show at the Comedy Store, which will be streaming live starting October 30th, which is an honor. And it's called Shit Gets Real. Yeah. And I'm going to be the host of the show. So I'm very excited. Of course, the Comedy Store is my home comedy club in Los Angeles, and I'm very, very excited to be a part of it and getting offered the show, which is a big deal for any comic to be offered to host a show at the Comedy Store. Anyways, our guest has joined us, and without further ado, just a quick intro on our very fantastic guest. Like I mentioned, he is better known by his stage name, Spec. He's a Canadian hip-hop musician. He is best known for his singles, Smell the Coffee and I'm a Hippie. Listen, anything to do with coffee, I'm about that life. I'm a caffeine addict. So without further ado, please welcome Hussein Spec Yusuf. Hussein, how are you, my friend?
I'm good. How's it going?
I can't. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You can hear me? Your volume is very low. I don't know why.
Any better?
Oh, so much better.
Yeah?
But there's an echo.
Okay. There is an echo. Maybe it's my mic. Give me a quick second. Yeah. Let me
oh, it's
stop
echo.
For a second.
Yeah.
I can hear you fine, but if... Are you still hearing
an echo? Yeah, the echo went away. I don't know what
happened. Okay.
Yeah. How are you, my friend? I know it's 7 a.m. in Dubai, so thank you for waking up super early to do that.
That's all good. How are you?
I'm good. I am very excited to have you on as a guest, and we have people who are tuned in and watching this because I try to bring in as many international guests as I can. And I was watching your video about Smell the Coffee and I'm a Hippie, and you know, you started off as a hip Canadian hip hop musician, dude. First of all, what your background is Sri Lankan, right, Spec?
Yeah. I my parents were born in Sri Lanka, but they were sort of first generation immigrants. All of their, I suppose, by coincidence, both of my parents were their young, you know, the sort of on the younger end of their siblings. All of their older siblings and their parents were born in India pre-partition, But in the 40s and 50s, when they moved to Sri Lanka, you know, they were Muslim Indians who, I guess, were, you know, had a choice of going to Pakistan or staying in India. But both my grandfathers were in the textile industry. And at that time, the real centers in Asia for textile were Madagascar and Sri Lanka. And so they just sort of coincidentally moved, both moved to Sri Lanka at the same time, and neither of them spoke Sinhalese. So my two grandfathers became friends, and then that's how my parents met.
Wow. So now, do you speak Sinhalese?
I don't. I mean, I was born in Canada and I was raised in Canada. So, and Sinhalese wasn't really, you know, sort of a language spoken by, you know, sort of the native language of the family. Yeah. So no, I don't speak it. I've certainly been to Sri Lanka a bunch of times. I go as often as I can. I love it out there. I don't speak Sinhalese. I'm a French Canadian at heart, I guess. So you get English and French from me, but not much else.
English and French. Yeah. That's a bit. My brother was getting, at a training from his job in Quebec. And he was like, dude, they are so strict about speaking French there. They are all about that French life.
I know. It's sort of gotten dark there a little bit in recent years. You know, when I was there, we certainly felt the sort of rub of the language issue in, you know, Montreal was always sort of the hotbed of the debate around the French language in Canada. And as I got older into my teens, there were a lot of political debates. You know, they had a referendum when I was living there when I was a teenager, where they wanted to separate from Canada to try and preserve the French language. So it's always been a very, you know, sort of hot topic, and it's become even more after I left Canada a long time ago. But in the years since I've left, they've since had like language police introduced, and, you know, it's become a lot more hardcore about the preservation of the French language. So yes, I lived through all of that. And I, you know, the funny thing is that I never really, I'm terrible with languages, really. You know, I mean, I love the English language. That's why I got into hip hop. You know, I love the sort of manipulation of the English language is always sort of a favorite subject in school. Yeah. But beyond that, I've been generally terrible at languages, but they taught me French in school, but I never really learned. But one of my neighbors was a French kid and he didn't speak English. And so that's how I learned French. So I tell people all the time, I speak French, like George Bush speaks English, you know. It's sort of, I've got the equivalent of a Texan drawl, except in, Quebecois French, you know. Which is quite funny for a brown guy to watch a brown guy speaking French like that.
I mean, look, I like to see brown guys speak all kinds of languages. I'm about that. my thing is that do you have the word equal to in French of strategery? You remember strategery during the Bush era? You remember that?
Yeah. No, I don't. I'm so rusty with my French. But yes, I mean, the thing about Quebecois French is that it's sort of like, it's like Spanglish, you know. It's like, it's a mix. When you don't know how to fill in a word, you just sort of say it in English with a French accent, and it sort of works in Montreal that way.
Got it. So you start off as a musician at 14. I mean, which is a, you know, the cool thing. Like, how are your this is going to be very dissy of me to ask you this. How were your parents about, like, being like, oh, you're going to become a musician at, like, 14? Like, what's going on here? You're not going to go. I know that you briefly went to college and you pursued law, but at 14, like, that's a big deal.
Oh, no. I definitely didn't pursue law, although I now think I sort of now fancy the idea of doing it, you know. But no, I never pursued law. I went to college for about 2 months and I dropped out and I joined a rap group.
Got it.
And, you know, so when I was 14, I went to a school in the East End of Montreal, which is the sort of Little Italy of Montreal. So I was like the only brown kid in a school of, it was me, one other kid and a black kid. And we were the only kids of color in a school of about 2,000 students, you know?
Wow.
So our teachers were Italian, the principal, the vice president, everybody was Italian. It was sort of like growing up in a Scorsese movie, you know? It really felt like Brooklyn, you know, in a Scorsese movie. And so one of the kids in school sort of said to me one day, he had sort of discovered hip hop. It was the late 80s. And he walked into class with headphones and he was like blasting what I now know is like De La Soul's Say No Go, which came out around 89. And it was just, I'd hear these horns, you know, like, and you could hear it through sort of the headphones in class. And I was like, what is that? Like, who comes in listening to sound like these loud jazz horns, you know? And I said, what are you listening to, you know? And he was like the most popular kid in school. He was sort of, he was an Irish by background. And so he just put the headphones on my head and I heard it for the first time. And it was like, I was mind blown away. You know, I was like, wow, what is this, you know? And he had a little rap group in school. And so he was just like, yo, you're like the only brown guy in school. Like, you got to have soul. Like, you know, why don't you join my rap group, you know? And it was as simple and stupid as that. And, you know, and so then I went home that day and I wrote my first rap and I came back the next day to school and I showed it to him. And he was just like, you didn't write that, you know? And I was like, no, I did, you know? And he was just like, all right, your homework for today is to go home and write a rap about people who pretend to write raps that they didn't really write, right? Wow. And so I went home that day and I did that. And I came in the next day and I performed it for him. And then he sort of was like, oh, you should join my group. And so, you know, I joined his group and we would meet up every day after school and we'd freestyle in the park. And I, through him, I really learned, I went down the deep rabbit hole of old school hip hop, you know, I got into the old Rakim stuff. And he really gave me an education in early hip hop. And you know, at that time, it was really just the beginnings of what they call the golden era of hip hop, where some of the most interesting and innovative and creative records were starting to come out. And so we lived through that period. And from about 14 to 17, I was sort of in this group with him. About a year after we started the group, this group called the Dream Warriors were the biggest hip hop group in Canada. And, you know, at that time, having rap groups coming out of Canada was a very super, it was the first time that was happening, you know? And so we went to this record store and they had an autograph. So we skipped school, went to the record store and, you know, there were like 1,000 kids in there and waiting to queue up to get an autograph. And I had this sort of old school magazine of the first interview the band had done, you know, sort of on paper and stuff. And I got to the front of the line and I said to them, you know, like they looked at me because everybody else had just bought a CD inside the shop and asked them the autograph. I was the only one who had some sort of, you know, some sort of remnant of their beginnings of their career. And so they were like, yo, why don't you come down to the show? And I was like, well, you know, I'm 14 and it's being done at a club. It's 18 and over where there's booze, so they won't let us in. And so they said, well, why don't you show up to soundcheck and we'll sneak you in, you know? And I'd never been to a concert before in my life. So, you know, I got together with my homies and I begged my parents to go to this concert. And I went and we ended up hanging out with them, you know, and we got there about 5-6 o'clock. They were literally just standing outside of the club having a chat. And right. We spent 2 hours with them just, you know, talking about the music scene in Montreal and about our high school rap group and the rest of it. And, you know, at the end of the process, they said, you know, oh, you freestyle, you know, like, why don't you freestyle for me? You know, and so we start rapping for them. And then they were like, you know, we want to produce like new groups out of Canada. You know, if you ever come to Toronto, you know, this is our phone number. Give us a call. We'll produce your demos.
Wow.
And really from about the age of about 14, 15 to about 17, I would just dip out to Toronto every chance that I got. My parents half the time didn't know where I was. And so, yes, it was a point of contention. But I think eventually they got to the point where they realized that this was something that I was really sort of serious about. And it all came to a head one day when I snuck out of the crib and stayed out all night, and then showed up at 8 a.m. with my parents assuming that I was never coming back. And so we had a big sort of row in the house that morning. But at the end of the process, they sort of understood how important it was to me. And, you know, my dad sort of encouraged me, you know, I showed him a letter that I had written, and he had sort of encouraged me to, you know, he was like, wow, this is really well written, you know, you should write more, you know? And I was like, well, that's kind of what music is. That's what rap music is to me, you know? And that was sort of a turning point. And from that point onwards, they really just supported anything I did, even though I think in their heart of hearts, they were really worried about it, you know, because at that time, hip hop was really, it hadn't commercialized, you know. I mean, so like hip hop clubs were 99.9% in like super hood areas of the city. You know, people were getting shot and stabbed at every hip hop show. And I was always the only brown guy in the spot, you know.
Right.
The hip hop community in Montreal at that time was Haitian, and the Haitian community was pretty rough, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they worried a great deal about that. But, you know, to their credit, they sort of, you know, figured that I'd figure it out. And so when I was 17, and I dropped out of college, they were just like, okay, you know, I mean, I guess you're going to do your thing. And I left, you know, and I moved to Toronto on my own. I had no job. I had no income. I had no nothing, you know, I just left, you know. I ended up moving in with some of the guys in the Dream Warriors, and they were recording their second album at the time.
Yeah.
And they asked me to record a few songs, and two songs became three. And then they said, do you want to join the group?
Yeah.
And so I ended up joining the first group I ever went to go see live, you know, and then overnight we were touring around, you know, I think right after we finished the record, we went to the UK, but by then the band was big in the UK, and we started touring Europe, and I, you know, sort of lived the dream for the next 4 years. We did a few albums together, and when the band broke up, I moved to London to try it solo.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things you said about when you moved out, was that like, were your parents were like, what are you going to do? Like, here's 2000 Canadian dollars. Here you go. Let us help
No,
you
nothing. I mean, there was, I don't remember asking them for anything. I think I just left. You know, they would hear from me every once in a while, and they were supportive, but they had no idea what the hell I was doing.
Was it like you getting into an argument or a fight with them one night and being like, I'm out?
No, it was, I mean, that argument night happened when I was like, when I, you know, I dipped out and I went out to like a party. And I wanted to go to this party, and I would leave a note for my dad on the, my dad worked night shift at the time, right? So I would leave like a note for my dad, and I'd say, you know, I want to go to this party. Is this okay? And in the morning, he'd leave me a note saying yes or no, or be back by midnight, or whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
And so I left him a note, and for whatever reason, he said no. And so at about 7 or 8 o'clock, I just sort of stuffed my bed, as you do. And we lived in a second floor apartment, and so I opened the window and I jumped out the window onto the balcony, and then I climbed down the stairwell, and I left, you know, and I went out and I partied like hell with my homies, and by about 7 or 8 o'clock, I came back and I was demonstrably inebriated at 14. You know, they were worried, you know, my mom was really upset. You know, by the time I come back about 7 or 8 a.m. and there's a sign on the back of the door, like, don't try jumping back into your window from the balcony, like the back door is open, right?
Wow.
And, And so I walk back in the door, and my mom's crying and stuff and upset. And I came in and I had this chat with my dad, and then that sort of turned into an argument. But like I said, by the end of it, we sort of came to an understanding, you know? And from that day forward, it was like they were like super supportive, you know, even if they didn't necessarily believe in it, you know? Which I don't know a lot of friends who have that, you know? So they really got it. I mean, they certainly didn't think that I was going to become a famous rapper in Canada or the UK or whatever it is, and then become a music publisher and be a entrepreneur. I mean, I didn't know that was my future. I certainly thought that my life was going to be one of an artist for the rest of my life. And I was quite happy with that, you know? I don't know. I guess they sort of saw the conviction that I had, and they supported me, you know? And then of course, once it was soon after I joined the Dream Warriors, and of course we were putting out videos, and the equivalent of MTV in Canada was Much Music at that time. And, you know, they supported us a lot. So the video would be on TV all the time in Canada. We had a comic book, you know, it sort of blew up in Canada. And then they would hear me on the radio or see me on TV all the time. And so they were like the proudest parents ever, you know?
Yeah.
They didn't understand what the hell I was doing, but they knew that I was doing what I wanted. So they supported it.
Do you feel like with a lot of like immigrant parents, because you got your first generation and they're immigrants, there's always this sense of, because being an artist is such a kind of far-fetched idea, right? It's like this dream, like they want to live in certainty. What is certainty? Going to medical school, becoming an engineer, becoming a lawyer. Those are certainties. But it sounds like your parents were like, if we keep pushing back against on him, he's just going to keep doing and probably keep doing more, even more fucked up things. And we don't want to get into more fucked up things. So let's just be part of this journey wherever he's going. At least we get to keep an eye on him.
Yeah. So like there's a bit of like, my parents were hippies growing up in the 60s. And I think that there's something to be said about the fact that they were immigrant children, first generation immigrant children as well, although it was Sri Lanka. And if you look at sort of the context of Asia, certainly at that time in Sri Lanka in the 70s, it wasn't uncommon for an 18-year-old kid boy to show up to pick up a girl at the house, take her out on a date, and while she's getting ready, have a drink with her dad. You know, in Sri Lankan culture, that could happen. You know, that was normal.
Even
right?
In Muslim families, Spec?
Less so in the Muslim families, but actually, you know. I mean, I think some people might debate this, but, you know, in Sri Lanka, nowadays you'll have communities that are, you know, sort of quite conservative, even in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
But at that time, everybody's sort of mixed up, you know. I mean, the Muslim community in Sri Lanka, I think is about 30 or 40% of the population, you know, so it's a significant part of the population, but the majority of the population is Buddhist. And so, you know, culturally it almost feels like the West Indies in a lot of ways, in that the liberalism of it, you know, you definitely weren't getting that sort of liberal sort of society in India or Pakistan at the time, you know?
Sure.
So and then when you add on to that fact that my grandparents were Indian immigrants, so my grandparents were sort of like what Asian parents would be in Canada, you know, like, because they were Indian and they had the Indian culture, which was a lot more conservative, and they wanted to sort of maintain that within the household, even though outside the household it was super Western. You know, girls wore mini skirts even back then, you know, in Sri Lanka, where that might not have been the case in Pakistan or India.
Yeah.
And so Sri Lanka has always been this sort of liberal outpost, you know, in the middle of Asia, you know.
Mm-hmm.
for whatever reason, I don't know why it is. One could argue that maybe it's because of the majority of the country is Buddhist, but there's definitely a live and let live sort of attitude in Sri Lanka.
Are the Muslims too? I mean, is that kind of? I would think. Look, I'm Pakistani, and I was born and raised in Pakistan till I was 15, and even to this day, I mean, even in I would say more on the upper echelon, like the more wealthier families, they get to drink and wear mini skirts and party and do whatever the hell they want. There's that double standard. But if you're middle class or if you're poor, I mean, you're definitely very conservative. There are no mini skirts to be found, Spec.
Definitely. I mean, there's another added element to this, which is actually a little bit more personal, which is my father's older brother was a motorcycle racer in Asia. He was my uncle Farouk, but when he was quite a rebel himself. So my father's family were, sort of well-to-do. My grandfather on my father's side was sort of a successful entrepreneur, textile entrepreneur in Sri Lanka. Very wealthy, friends with, politicians, that sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And his son, which is my father's elder brother, was a rebel, and he ran away from home when he was 14. And he stowed away on a British Navy ship that was docked in Sri Lanka at the time. And he disappeared, for the next 4 years. And in that time, he traveled around the world. He got tatted up, sort of good-looking guy. Ended up in London.
Okay.
The legend has it that he got in a bar fight in London at 17, broke a bottle over somebody's head, and killed them accidentally. And so he was arrested. And they didn't know what to do with him, because he was an illegal immigrant in the country. So they deported him back to Sri Lanka. So he shows up now. After missing for 4 years, back at his parents' place, and he's fully tatted up and the whole thing. And his father's like a successful business guy. People weren't getting tatted, like brown guys weren't getting tatted up unless they were serious criminals at that time. He had down to his fingers, clubs, spades, diamonds, hearts. His childhood sweetheart when he was 14, her name was Silverine. He had her name tattooed across his chest.
Wow.
He was a badass,
Yeah.
And then he immediately stole his father's car and turned it into a stock car and then entered it into what they call a clubman class race, which is a qualifying race if you want to become a racer. And he won the race.
Yeah.
But he was arrested at the finish line because his father had called and said that somebody stole my car and checked the racetrack. Right. Yeah. And so my dad said to him, my dad had just gone to school in Pakistan for a couple of years. So my dad came back and said to him, the name Khan is like really popular in Pakistan, but it was an unknown name at that time in Sri Lanka.
Okay.
And he said, why don't we come up with a name for you so dad doesn't know it's you that's racing? And so his name was Farouk, so his nickname in school was Freaky. So they came up with this name, Freaky Khan. And he ended up racing under that assumed name. And then he became sort of more and more famous. And of course, when you're racing, you've got a helmet on, so nobody knows what you look like, right? Especially at that time, it was television being as ubiquitous as it is. So for the first few years, his father didn't know that he was this guy, Freaky Khan, that was winning all these races, that was sort of Sri Lankan's champion racer, until eventually somebody told him, that's your son, right? And he got confronted by his father, and then his father supported him, right? And he ended up racing as part of the Sri Lankan team, and they raced across Asia, Singapore, and so on. And they raced in India at the Grand Prix, and he won the Grand Prix 2 years in a row. And both years he won all four events. So he would enter a race on a 250cc bike and then win the 250 race, the 350, the unlimited 1,000cc up, and the Grand Prix itself. And so he sort of had this legendary status as the daredevil racer of the track. And he lived fast and died young. He died when he was 33. I was about 6 years old at the time.
Whoa.
He was a heavy drinker. He, the guy's life was insane, So when I was a kid, so he died. I was in Sri Lanka at the time when he died. And so it had a big impact on me. And so when I was sort of rebelling against my parents, I was sort of identifying with him, you know, and I told them that, you know, like, you know, nobody really gets me in this family, you know, just like my uncle. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe that was sort of a bridging thing that brought them to just sort of, you know, pull the steam down and then sort of try and engage with me before I went off and did something crazy, you know?
Sure.
And that was, I think, a big part of where they just learned to accept it, you know, and figured, okay, well, we don't get what he's doing at all, but we got to let him do it, you know?
Right. Now, Speck, you have two kids. Do you have, are they teenagers yet?
Not yet, but they're getting there. They're 10 and 12.
10 and 12. Okay. And are you seeing some of yourself in either one of them? You have a boy and a girl, right?
Yeah. 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 I see myself, a lot in both of them. You know, my son is a lot like me in that he's sort of, he's quite chill. And most people that meet him say, oh, this guy's like a carbon copy of you. My daughter, definitely has the sort of freaky con in her, you know, and, she's, you know, sort of wildly creative and, a bit of a hothead.
Okay. I feel like some of that stuff is so, genetic, like it's so ingrained. You're just like pre-designed to be a certain way because, it's funny because I am a replica of my mom. If you put me and my mom next to each other, we look like twins, but my personality is nothing like my mother. It is a replica of my dad, like, you know, out there fucking fast and hard, rebelling, doing whatever the fuck we want, just saying whatever, you know, just very, very.
How are they with you becoming, you know, getting into comedy and sort of going that direction? That would have been a very weird one, I'd imagine, at the time.
Man, I feel like maybe I should have been born in Sri Lanka. Now I'm listening to you. Like, you could wear mini skirts back in like the 80s and 90s. This is amazing.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't like that at all. I was never set out to become a stand-up comic. I wanted to become a stage actor. That's what I really wanted. And yeah, my family was not having it, Speck. I'm the youngest and the only girl in the family. I have four older brothers. So in essence, I grew up in a military camp, if you just really think about it, because, you know, it's like you grew up in a fucking fort, protected by two parents and four older brothers. What the hell you think you're going? But I always found a way to sneak out and do whatever the hell I needed to do. And I didn't give a shit about the repercussions. But yeah, no, I was never really... I never really kind of planned out to become a stand-up comic. I just kind of fell into stand-up comedy. But when I came out of my artist closet to my family, I was given an ultimatum because I live with my brothers here. My parents always lived in Pakistan, and they gave me an ultimatum. They said, either you're going to go to college and become a physical therapist, or we're going to send you back to Pakistan, and our parents are going to marry you off. So take your pick. Right. And I was like, neither. I love you. But fuck off. And I packed up my shit and I left, man. I had a giant, ginormous fight one night and I was like, I'm out. I just can't be a part of this, you know?
Yeah.
I can't let you crush my dreams. And I feel like, you know, it's like, it's, I wish that my parents did what your parents did with you, right?
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about it, like when you talk about the, you know, the brown parents thing and, you know, the Desi parents and how difficult it is to sort of get them to get their head around the arts, you know, for us, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a unique perspective on it because when I was, like, I grew up in a very I didn't grow up around brown people, you know? I grew up in French Montreal, and then I moved to the little Italy of, so I never really had a reference point for the conservatism that I now know is sort of part of the community. You know, I was always different and I had no reference point. Right. And then I moved to Toronto, when I was 17, and that was the first time where I was surrounded by like loads of Desis, you know, and the Caribbean community as well. I moved in with, three of the guys in the Dream Warriors are Jamaican. So then I moved in with them. So I was sort of West Indian surrogate for a while. Right. And then I moved in with my buddy Chin, who was in a band as well. And he it was the same thing. He was an Indian kid bass player. He's gone on to do amazing things. He's produced Eminem and 50 Cent and all kinds of people. But when he started basically in a soul funk band in Canada called Bass is Bass. And we ended up moving in together. And then we were the only two brown guys in Canada who had record deals. And what? All of a sudden, the Asian community in Canada really embraced us, you know. So then suddenly at Dream Warrior shows, there'd be loads of brown kids at the concerts because they all saw one of their own on stage for the first time, you know. Right. And then when I moved to London, I worked at Nitz & Sawney, and I was part of the whole Asian underground scene over there, which was sort of drum and bass and hip-hop mixed with Indian music. And then I moved to the Middle East, you know. And so everywhere I've gone, I've sort of I feel like I've walked into the birth pangs of brown kids starting to discover the arts. And I've always been the first one, you know what I mean? I was the first one to do it, you know what I mean? Yeah. To a lot of these kids.
Yeah.
And so as a result, I'm now 45. So now, you know, I have the, you know, now I'm an executive, you know what I mean? Because I've lived that life. Now I'm meeting 20-year-old kids who are doing what I was doing back then. And they think that they're being, you know what I mean? But it's a little bit easier for them, you know, because now there's a few other people there and they've got somebody to look at. Now there's Hassan and Anik Khan and yourself and myself. And there's just, it's different, you know? Now you, in Toronto, you turn on the TV, the news reporter is an Indian guy or Pakistani or Sri Lankan or whatever it is. And that wasn't what I saw when I grew up. I just saw white people, you know? Now that I see, like, I'm, you know, at the moment, so I just signed an Indian rapper artist named Divine, you know, who's...
I love him.
Yeah, you know, he's just dropping a new single this morning. You have to watch this video.
Oh, my God, congrats. I cannot... Yeah, please. Is it Mirchi?
Yes, yeah, it's so dope. The video is dropping in an hour or something, you know? So, but yeah, it's such a banger and he's so dope. But, you know, I started going to India a lot over the past 5 years. And, you know, 10 years ago when you go to India, you talk to them about hip hop and the music scene was intrinsically linked to the Bollywood scene. And the only way that music would be popular was if it was propelled through some sort of Bollywood film machine, you know? Suddenly there's a kid like Divine who grows up literally in the slums, you know, in an industry that is completely manufactured typically, you know, and he comes out of the slums and he captures the imagination of the country because he becomes a big famous rapper and he's talking some real shit about what's going on in the streets of the slums, which nobody has ever, that perspective has never been sort of brought to the mainstream, you know? And when I, last year I was there when he did the album launch for his record Koinoor. And, you know, it was amazing. You know, it's like they, I think 3 or 4 days just before the album launch, they just decided to put on a show and like 6,000-7,000 kids just showed up to this, you know, sort of airfield where they decided to put on this free concert, you know?
Okay.
And, or actually, I'm not sure if it was free, but it was a concert. And now there's a really vibrant hip hop scene that really reminds me of Toronto in the 90s. You know, when people talk to me about hip hop happening now in India and the Middle East and throughout Asia and Africa, and not just hip hop, but just like an organic independent music community that's starting to develop where there's kids that are really starting to own and create their own, you know, create their own sound. That wasn't the case, you know, 10 years ago when you had those conversations. Now it sort of moved on, and there's a really vibrant and interesting community out there. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's going to go really global. You know, I think that the future of music is going to be informed by ethnicity and local language. And I think that Despacito was not an anomaly. It was just a taster of what's to come from all around the world, whether that's BTS and South Korea or India or Arabic or, you know, Afrobeats, you know? So it's a really exciting time. Now I feel like I'm like the old guy in the room watching all these guys sort of follow through on what we thought was possible, but is now only just starting to happen, you know?
But you know what the cool thing is, Spec, is that, you know, with Divine and especially with like someone like you who was, you know, there in the beginning and basically kind of helps be one of the foundation, one of the building block foundations for other artists that are now coming out, you know, who are of brown descent to become hip hop artists or whatever the genre they're getting into. I feel like you're not the old man. You are the lucky one who got to be an artist, and now you get to be an entrepreneur, and now you basically get the best of both worlds, in my opinion.
I feel the same way. I transitioning from an artist to an entrepreneur was sort of a difficult one, in the sense that I always felt like an imposter. You know, in my first few years doing business, when I first got offered my first job in publishing, I was 30. So up until the age of 30, I had just been an artist 24/7, you know, and I've been, you know, a relatively successful one. You know, I bought houses and, you know, I was touring around the world and I was doing well with it, signed publishing deals and record deals and the rest of it. But it's one of those things where when I got offered my first job, I wasn't sure if I, like you say, my single, I'm a hippie. I never really meant that as a literal like statement. It was always to me an ironic statement sort of thing. Cause the chorus sort of goes back and forth between, you know, I'm a hippie, but I got a tattoo, I'm a Rasta, but I got short hair. It was meant to be talking about contradictions, but it ended up sort of sounding like me just saying I'm a hippie, you know, which is fine. I mean, I knew that that would be the case as well. But I always thought I was going to be a hippie artist. You know,
yeah.
I didn't think I was going to ever have a 9-to-5 job at all. Not that this is 9-to-5, but it's more like 9-to-3, you know, but AM. I didn't think that that was the thing. And actually, when I got offered it and I started first going into meetings, of course, I started going into music companies, except now as an executive. And I knew a lot of these people because they knew me as an artist trying to get a rec deal or publishing deal or whatever. So for that reason alone, I felt like an imposter, you know. Right. And then I realized over time that in the music industry, the people who actually know how to make music, you know, who have actually had the experience of touring and getting jerked on contracts and having bad managers and good managers and going through the system, is quite an anomaly, you know. Not a lot of people have that experience, you know, and can actually relate to now an artist who's going through that and understand, you know. I mean, you know, when you're a 17-year-old kid and you're sort of famous in your home country, right? Yeah. And you walk into a subway or you walk into a mall and kids are asking you for autographs, that's a weird experience, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you don't quite know what to make of it at the time. I mean, you dream of it, that's what you wanted and all of that. But when it actually happens and you're like going into a mall or you're trying to date a girl and she thinks she's believing all these weird things that some of her friends in college are telling, these weird mythologies about me, you know?
Yeah.
Then you're like, this is weird, you know? And I've been through that, you know, and
right.
I didn't go off the rails. So I think now when I talk to Divine or I talk to any of the artists that I work with, you know, I come at it from a place where, you know, it's like I can listen to a shitty demo and just be like, oh my God, that chorus is amazing. You need to you know, just build out the production a little bit more. And I have some authority when I say that, because I actually know, I think I know what I'm talking about, you know?
Right.
So, so, you know, it's now in retrospect, my point is that, I value, a lot, you know, I was scared of my first 30 years as an artist, you know, now I embrace it. Cause it's like, I know that I learned so many weird things that you can't read in a book, you know?
Right.
And now I try to help some of those other kids who are trying to do what I was doing, except I can help them more because actually there's somebody like me who knows, you know what I mean? Who, you know, in 97, I was recording demos where I was sampling Indian music and tablas and Bollywood records and putting hip hop beats behind it. This is like pre-Timbaland and Missy Elliott. And at that time when I would play it, you know, I was still in the Dream Warriors and I was just shopping demos for my solo career.
Yeah.
And I remember one A&R said to me, if you give me, at the time that Blackstreet song, No Diggity was big. And he's like, give me No Diggity with a sitar and I'll sign you, you know? And I felt it was such a shitty thing to say at the time, right? And, you know.
Spec, it's the equivalent of, I have black, you know, friends, actor friends. When they go and audition and they're like, yeah, can you make it a little bit more urban for me?
Yeah, exactly.
Or they tell me to put on an Indian accent or Pakistani. Can you make it a little bit more Indian? Can you make it a little more Pakistani? And you're just like, do you want me to just rub curry all over my body at this point? What would you like?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing, you know? And so now, like, now I look at it like, yo, you know, like I, you know, if I'm talking to Divine about, you know, a new song or whatever it is, it's like I have some perspective that is useful to him, I think, you know, rather than being a complete outsider who doesn't have some sort of context for what they're trying to build culturally or what it means to them to embody their story in an authentic way. You know, so like I encourage, for example, you know, like one of the, I was in India a couple of years ago at a conference, and one of the questions from the audience at the end was an Indian girl, you know, and she sort of put it out to the audience. And she was like, you know, I really want to like be successful. Do I have to sing in English? You know, and there was a whole debate amongst you know, the panelists, you know, yes, it'll help if you go global, right? And I don't know, I think I flubbed my way through that response, but I thought about it a lot after, you know, and I still think about that question, you know? And I think it's bullshit to want to run towards the paradigms that have existed and assume that that's what, you know, we don't have to water down what we do in order to gain global recognition. You know, you don't need, that was the paradigm, you know, during the British invasion and the Beatles, you know, sure, you know, but in 2020, my argument to a lot of these people is, you know what, double down on who you are, you know, because that is, completely unique. You know, Drake can't be like Divine, you know? Right. I mean, Drake can be the best Drake he can be, you know, but he can never do what Divine does, you know?
Right.
And Divine shouldn't try to do what Drake does.
That's
you
correct.
Know what I mean? Like, I mean, we're all influenced by global hip hop or, you know, sort of R&B or whatever it is, but this idea of sort of wearing your identity on your sleeve is something that I think is super important. And I actually don't think it's a kink in your armor. I think it actually makes you stronger, you know?
Right.
And I say that like to my Arab artists as well, like, yo, I don't want an English record necessarily, you know, let's do Arabic language because the world is becoming a global place.
That's right.
And it is a global place. And, you know, just the methods of dissemination have changed, right? Like it used to be a CD business. And when it was a CD business, Africa and Asia was 90%+ piracy. So we never made any money out of Asia and Africa, right? As an industry, right? With streaming, it's not being pirated. It's coming in through telcos and the rest of it. And so for the first time since streaming has entered the fray, and it's only really entered the fray in Asia and Africa in the past like 2 years, really, you know? Wow. And so it's super early days still, right? It took 10 years for Spotify to enter before it overtook the industry in the US, right? So one could look at Asia and Africa and say, well, you know, we're in year two, you know, by about year seven, right? You're going to have billions of people in Africa and India and Pakistan and China streaming, and music rights holders and artists getting paid whatever, a fraction of a penny on every stream, but they're going to get paid on every stream.
Right.
You know, they weren't getting paid like that. They weren't getting paid on every sale. You know, they're more, in some case, some markets, it was 95-98% piracy, you know?
Oh my goodness. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a complete paradigm shift. You know, the US used to be the biggest market. It still is the biggest music market in the world, but that's not because it's the biggest market in the world. It's because it was the biggest big regulated market in the world.
That's right.
But there's still 320 million people there and 1.3 or so in India, you know? So if you get the same percentage of people streaming in India, then it's going to be a bigger, it's absolutely going to be a bigger market, you know? And that's undeniable, you know? And so in the next 6 years, either India or China is going to overtake America as the biggest music markets in the world. And when that happens, what do you think is going to happen to the way that we self-define or self-perceive what pop music is, right? If a song is getting 2 billion streams in a month, right, and you're the head of some major record label in LA, you're trying to sign somebody in that market, or you're trying to get Beyonce to do a duet with whoever's in that market because you want those streams.
Sure.
And so there's an inevitability of local language and sort of cultural identity becoming the new fabric of pop. It's not going to be about Britney. It's not going to be like super white Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera, you know, or Backstreet Boys. You know, that was an era and it made sense at that time. This is going to be a new era where pop culture is going to start to reflect the economies of scale that are coming out of all of these other markets that have really been untapped for a long time, you know? And so it's a really interesting time. And we're seeing it even in film, you know? Like, look how much Asian content is cropping up on Netflix, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and Amazon and Disney and the rest of it, you know?
Everywhere.
So it's a really, really exciting time for this, you know, sort of for Asia and Africa opening up, which is exactly why I left New York after 5 years and I moved back to the Middle East to focus in on those opportunities.
So, Spike, I have a question. So, a few questions. I mean, this is so great. Now you're in Abu Dhabi or are you in Dubai?
I live in Dubai, but my office is in Abu Dhabi.
Your office is in Abu Dhabi. So now that you moved back, I mean, you have your whole life there. You know, you got your wife and your kids and everything. How has music been? I mean, how are artists even able to get together during the pandemic and even record together? I mean, the pandemic has just, you know, basically decimated a lot of, I mean, look, my business is pretty much decimated right now. So.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, it's hard to say, you know, I mean, it's.
I mean, are they getting?
I can tell you I can tell you from a practical perspective, people, what we've seen with our writers, the songwriters signed to us, is they move from doing sessions to doing Zoom sessions, you know, and nowadays everybody's got a music studio in their house. It's super affordable. And so it's actually just as easy as making this call happen. You know, you can record a song that way. And I know, I mean, I recorded a song with Nitin Sawhney on his new album, which is dropping very soon. And, you know, I recorded the vocals over here. I sent it to him over there. He produced it and mixed it, came out as a single. And
Are you talking about Pilgrim or Immigrant?
So I was on Pilgrim, and then he and I recorded a song called Lifeline on his new album called Immigrants. Lifeline dropped as a single about a month ago.
Got it. You know, I remember watching Gully Boy, which is a, you know, which is a mainstream Indian movie. And I remember watching it and just being so blown away by it because I had listened to Divine before. And I was just, because I'm also a big fan of Raja Kumari, who is an LA artist, and now she lives in India, which is a very interesting choice on her part, but I guess that's where her fan base is. But I remember watching Divine Story and watching Gully Boy and just being so blown away by it, just being so moved by it. And, you know, so I look at somebody like Divine. I don't know what kind of artists are coming out of China. I'm sure they're speaking, you know, Mandarin or Cantonese or whatever they're singing in. You know, but the one success that has, like, really shocked the shit out of me is Blackpink and BTS, the Korean pop. I mean, K-pop is massive. I mean, they are massive. You know, I remember listening to them on the radio, and I was just like, nobody knows what the fuck they're saying. What are they saying? Like, I don't know. The beat is so good. I'm, like, listening to it, but I have no idea what they're saying. You know what I'm saying? Do you think is that the future of music where you're just like, I'm going to bop to this beat, but I don't know what they're saying, but I'm going to bop to it?
I think it is, but I think that you're going to just start to see a lot of cross collaborations. And so maybe you'll know what they're saying in one verse, but you won't for another two verses, you know? And it'll be a mix like that. I mean, if you think about it, you know, like, you see, like, okay, Tacky Tacky with Cardi B and, you know,
Azuna and Selena Gomez.
There's a bunch of pop artists on that one.
Yeah.
And it was a mix, you know, it was sort of Spanish, English, you know, and it worked in so many markets because it was a mix. I mean, at the moment, Mirchi with which is dropping now, I got to shout out Divine on that one. You know, that's one where it's Divine and some of the guys in his crew, and it's with Stylo G, who's a British Jamaican dancehall artist, you know. And Stylo's really blown up at the moment in the dancehall and reggae scene, you know, doing really well in that space, you know. So what does dancehall have to do with, you know, Indians doing rapping in Hindi? You know, how does that sort of work, you know? But it does. It totally works, you know, and it sounds awesome, you know?
Right.
And so I think there's going to be a lot more of that sort of thing.
Right. You know, I always feel like people like Divine or even other artists, you know, I mean, hip hop came out of a need to make a statement. Right, the ultimate, like, you know, there's this great documentary on Netflix called Hip Hop Evolution. It's like literally one of my favorite docs I've ever seen.
Yeah,
it's freaking dope. And you know, you watch the evolution of hip hop and why, you know, the rappers were coming out and saying what they were saying. I feel like Divine is one of those rappers that makes a statement, like, hey, I come from the slums, like, but this is the shit that's going down. I'm trying to keep it real. Are there other rappers and other artists that are coming up in India and Pakistan, you know, that are in the hip hop world that are kind of making similar statements that aren't making it about, you know, what is happening in their world?
Yeah. I mean, we announced, so I sort of have a dual role where I'm, you know, I moved back to Middle East to sort of, I started my company Pop Arabia, and then in 2015 I got offered a job in New York at Reservoir, which is an independent music publisher.
Yeah.
And so I moved to New York in 2015, and then I moved back last year to focus on Asia and Africa. And I'd say about 2-3 months ago, we announced that we had signed Divine to his first, you know, sort of publishing deal, and that we had done a joint venture with Gully Gang, which is his entertainment company. And as he signs and develops the next wave of Indian rappers with stories to tell, you know, we are going to be signing those artists with him, you know, through his company. So, so we're excited about, you know, not just investing in Define, but being on the front lines of the next wave of hip hop groups. And it's not rocket science. I mean, you really just have to look at what happened in America. You know, this is, this is 1992, you know, in America right now, and we're creating the Bad Boys and the Death Rows right now, except we're creating them in ancient Africa, you know?
Where's the Foxy Brown and the Little Kim spec?
Where's Well, that's a good question. We gotta find them, you know? And that's the thing. It's like, you really can just look at the landscape and be like, oh, I really should find, you know, think about how we can find somebody that fills a similar gap that, you know, a similar space as some artists that you loved in the 90s, you know? And I think you'll see very similar patterns emerge, even though it's obviously contextualized to that market, you know? So, you know, MC Altaf, who's featured on the Divine single, Mirchi, is probably next up, you know what I mean? In India through Gully Gang. But they've got a whole crew of like really dope MCs, you know? We're looking at all of them. We're looking to support them and build them up into the next generation of hip hop talent.
I am a big fan of, so I watch Black is King, of course, because I'm obsessed with everything Beyonce. I've watched it twice, actually. I can't believe I'm confessing this on air, but I'm a huge fan. And one of the artists that one of my dear friends in New York is Nigerian, and he was just like, oh my god, have you listened to Burna Boy? I was like, who is Burna Boy? I must listen to him. And now all these like amazing artists are emerging from like Nigeria, and just like you said, you know, different African nations. That you're just like, I didn't know this incredible artist existed. Like, why are they not, you know, I can't wait to hear from them. Is that something that you're also focusing on? Is that what Pop Arabia is also focusing on? Like, signing up all this, like, new, amazing, upcoming talent? I mean, Burna Boy is already, he's already probably signed with someone, right?
Yeah, like, so my I'll give you an interesting statistic, right? So, and this is another thing that is informed by the advent of music streaming, right? Mm-hmm. So like in China, you're talking about China, right? Like what do they listen to in China, right? So in China, the statistic that I overheard the head of Tencent saying, right? Tencent owns five of the biggest streaming services in China, right? And so it's a big multimedia organization. And so 95% of the content available on Chinese music streaming services is international, is non-Chinese content, right? Wow. 95%, right? And 5% is Chinese content, right? But the 5% of Chinese content accounts for over 85% of the streams.
Wow.
Right? So if you're an enterprising entrepreneur, right, trying to figure out where the money is going to be in the next 10 years, I would recommend you go to China and sign a bunch of artists.
That's right.
And Africa and India. Because the thing is that we know, we've seen this movie before. We know how this is going. Streaming is going to continue to grow, right? And this will continue to sort of be a big way of monetizing content. And that being the reality, what we've learned from streaming services entering new markets is that it sort of tends to be about local music and local language in every market you go to. You know, the old model was I took Beyonce or the Beatles and I front racked it in your record shop. And because I was a record company, I was the only one who could actually physically distribute in all corners of the globe. You know, yeah. When I was Dream Warriors, if I didn't have a record deal, I couldn't get an album sold in a record shop in India because somebody had to own the global physical distribution network, right? With digital, that's completely abolished. And now you just go straight to the people, right? And when you give people the world's catalog at their fingertips at the end of a phone where they can choose whatever they want and they're not being bombarded with just, you know, usually the front rack stuff gets, you know, 80% of the footfall. And then that was the reason why, and the stuff that got front racked was the stuff being pushed by the big music companies, you know? And so as a result, you know, there was a, even if you were in, even if you were in Vietnam, you might be getting pushed Beatles and Beyonce and whatever it was, right? Now, because everybody's sort of, it's a completely democratized universe, people tend to be going back into their old classics that they grew up on, and that tends to be local music and local language and the rest of it. And so, there's this sort of new thing that's evolving where suddenly local music is much more important than it ever was, you know?
Right.
Nitin always says, you know, when in the 90s, when Nitin would always get called world music, you know, and he hated it. You know, he won world music awards, you know, and he was just like, I hate that term. He's like, that's a ghetto term. They're trying to ghettoize me, you know. I'm not a world music artist, you know. I'm an artist, you know, and I'm influenced by flamenco, and I'm influenced by hip-hop, and I'm influenced by African music and Indian music and, you know, guzzles and the rest of it, right? But that's not like this little category where you, you know, with 100 albums in the corner of the record store that nobody ever goes to, you know. I'm a global artist. I'm not, you know, this idea of world music he felt was very belittling, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that term world music is so, I mean, at the time, to be honest with you, I didn't get his beef, you know, but I get it now, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I think what we're going to see is like all pop music is going to be world music, you know,
right.
The majority of it, you know, and that's a shift that's happening in pop culture as we speak, you know, like you commented on my social network about Amjad Sabri. Right.
Oh, I was just going to talk about him. That's my childhood.
You know, we represent a Pakistani company called Hira Media. And about a year ago, we were approached because Coldplay wanted to sample Amjad Sabri on their new album, you know. That's kind of what I mean. You know what I mean? It's happening in every genre. It's happening. You know, why would they want to do that? And why, when they launched the album, did they open it in an open air concert on a rooftop in Jordan?
Right.
You know, they're the type of band that can do that. That's ostentatious stuff, you know. But I think that Coldplay sampling Amjad Sabri is, you know, a cousin of Stylo G and Divine doing a track together, which is a cousin of Tacky Tacky or Despacito or Gangnam Style. You know, this is happening in every corner of the globe, and it's happening in small spurts. But as streaming becomes more ubiquitous in a lot of these parts of the world, it's going to redefine the way that we look at pop culture.
I mean, Spec, I'm actually very, very excited. I feel, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I have a very eclectic taste. I like to listen to Yugoslavian rap. I will then go listen to Amjad Sabri. Then I will go listen to, A.R. Rahman. My playlist is just all over the place, right? I don't care. If it's good music, I connect to it, I listen to it, I don't care. I feel that in the next 15 years, globalization would be almost a thing of the past where it would be the normal. Globalization would be a normal thing. Like, if you are not with globalizing, you are a person of the past.
100%.
Like,
100%.
You need to, like, get with the times. And because I'm also seeing that in stand-up comedy, right? I feel like, I don't know if you know this, but all stand-up comedians secretly want to be rock stars. we have, like, this very secret. We don't like to share it. But Dave Chappelle recently let it out. So I was like, okay, if he said it, then I can also let that secret out. But for me, like, music is a very, very big part of my life. The shows that I do, the shows that I put on, the music that I like to go up to on stage, they play a huge role in my mindset as a stand-up and the kind of set I'm going to do. It plays a huge, huge role. But I feel like in stand-up comedy, we're still trying to bridge the gap because there are certain cultural nuances that, you won't understand unless you've been part of that, culture or you're aware of that culture. So it's kind of hard to get that kind of nuance thing, but I don't feel music has that. Am I correct? Like, music doesn't have that. Music very easily kind of transcends and just kind of crosses that border very, very easily.
I mean, it's a cliche, but music is, a really universal language. You don't really need language to understand it. To understand emotion. It's an emotional language, actually.
That's right.
And so because it's an emotional language, it's a universal language. You can feel completely captivated by something that you don't understand. I mean, I love the band Sigur Rós, which is an Icelandic band, and when they sing, they don't sing in any language. They just sing melodies like, They make up their own words, basically, right?
Yeah.
That don't mean anything to anybody, but it's about them finding the right emotional tone and melody for whatever's the best vehicle for that song, And what does it mean lyrically? I don't know, but it makes me want to cry, And nobody knows, But they've built an incredible career as just like, It's sort of like the most beautiful music that there's no way you can actually understand, but they've built a massive following that way, so there's, I think that, I don't like, I can understand basic Hindi these days, but I'm not fluent by any stretch of the imagination, but I've been listening to a lot of Indian music lately, and I love it, so I don't think that,
yeah.
Whether you speak a language or not should absolve you from,
right.
Connecting to it.
I was actually going to say that since the fact you're not fluent in Hindi, I was going to speak to you in Hindi for the next 15 minutes and just watch your face. You're like, what is going on? What is?
Yeah.
you're just slowly like turning the camera away from you. I won't catch the facial expressions. I want to ask you this, and this is something. You were kind enough to share this incredible gay Palestinian. Oh, sorry, can I say that? Okay, this Palestinian artist. Sorry, can I even say that? I don't want to say.
Yeah, of course.
In trouble.
I don't think it's a secret.
Okay. Because at the moment I saw, I was like, okay, first of all, let me just clarify why my gaydar has gotten good. Okay. I live in West Hollywood in Los Angeles. Now, if you have ever been to West Hollywood in Los Angeles, it is the gayest part of Los Angeles. Okay. I am my gaybers. I see them all the time. Most of my friends are gay, male gay friends. I have lesbian friends. So my gaydar is pretty high. So when I watched the video of this person that you sent me, and I was like, oh my God, how adorable is this? He's so cute. And he's adorable. What I wanted to ask you, when I watched him, the thought that went through my mind was, in America, in the West, I guess even in Dubai to a certain extent, you have the freedom to kind of express yourself however you wish. But and I know there are certain areas in the Middle East, not certain, most predominantly most of Middle East and even in South Asia, when it comes to sexuality and kind of freely expressing yourself the way you want to, even as an artist, whether it be music or however, it becomes restricted. It comes with repercussions. So, I mean, you're signing all these brilliant artists. They want to express themselves the way they want to. Have you thus far faced any backlash of any kind? And, you know, or do you expect to face any kind of backlash?
Yeah, I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm sure there's people who are not comfortable, you know, like we at Reservoir have signed every type of artist you can think of, you know,
yeah.
We've,
yeah.
You know, Young MA is signed to us, you know, she's, I think the first, you know, massive, you know, openly gay lesbian rapper, you know? And so, you know, I don't look at, you know,
well, in the West, it's fine.
Really any of that stuff when I'm like trying to find an artist, you know, I didn't sort of go looking for any particular thing. To be honest with you, what happened was I was invited to speak at a conference in Palestine, over a year ago now. Right. And, I think it was last April. Right. And so I'd never been to Palestine or Israel, so I was keen to check it out.
Yeah.
I was curious. I knew that I was in the process of moving back soon to the Middle East. And so I thought this is a great opportunity to see some new Arab artists. We want to sign, you know, some artists because of this, you know, sort of vision of where the music industry is going. So I go out to this gig and then somebody introduced me to the artist's name is Bashar Murad. So somebody introduced me to Bashar and we just met, you know, and started talking, you know, there was no, they mentioned that he was one of the artists that would be playing, but I hadn't heard his music. It was pretty cash. You know, we were sitting in my hotel room with a couple of friends and just chatting about Palestine and the music industry out there. And, you know, I just said to him, oh yeah, you know, when you're out there tonight, I'll come check you out, you know? Mm-hmm. And, but you know, in my head, I was like, I didn't think I was going to sort of meet, you know, like a gay Palestinian artist. That wasn't what I thought I was going to see when I come to Palestine to check out new music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw him play, you know, and he sort of came out. So the crowd was about, we were in Ramallah, there was about, I don't know, a few hundred locals, you know, and then a handful of the delegates from this conference. But it was by far the majority of the crowd was just locals who came in to see a show. And he came out on stage and he had like a wedding veil on, you know, and then when the chorus hit, he sort of took the veil off and, you know, really went for it, right? And it was a moment, you know, and I thought this guy's going to get like killed out here.
Yeah.
I've been to Palestine before. I had no idea, you know, all I knew was like what any of us see, you know, you watch TV and you have these, even me, who's somebody who's lived out here and I think is about as well educated on, you know, sort of the region and the subject as anybody, I thought, is this, you know, dangerous, you know?
Sure.
And they loved it, you know, they ate it up and he killed that show. He totally rocked that show, right? And it sort of, you know, I had a few people watching next to me who were like, whoa, I did not think this is what I was going to come see when I came down to Palestine, you know, and I certainly didn't think that that was the reaction that we'd get from a local crowd based on the sense that you sort of have this image of militancy or something like that in Palestine, you know, and the reality is very far from that for the average person, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was really interesting. I was sort of like, this guy's really interesting. Mm. You know, so we stayed in touch, you know, and he started sending me demos of things that he was working on. And then the song that you heard was a demo and I really liked it. And I said, you know, I think this is really good, but I think you know, we should get a producer, you know, get a producer involved, you know, and we have a producer assigned to Reservoir who named Gannon Arnold, who's a writer producer, and he's done all kinds of pop stuff, Now United and Demi Lovato and all kinds of stuff like that. And he loved the song and Bashar, and they started working long distance. So going back to what you're saying, you know, I mean, Bashar was in Palestine, Gannon was in LA, and they started working back and forth over the past year on that,
wow.
You know,
wow.
And that song was produced just recently, you know, and then we got Marcella Areca, who mixes all of the Timbaland stuff, you know, who's another one of our writers. She mixed it so it sound it's got that bump, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds like I think a global record, you know.
Yeah.
And even, you know, I describe it as, it sounds like a Holiday Inn song. Like, it sounds like a song you hear by a pool, you know, at a resort in the Caribbean, except it just happens to be in Arabic, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
And I thought that that was super interesting. You know, like, I'd never heard anything like that, you know, but
right.
It felt really like it encompassed this whole new world that we're going into, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, we signed him, we got him working, with Gannon. We have an EP that's queuing up to come out, very soon. And that single and video we've just shot, and we're dropping that in the next few weeks. So, very exciting, not at all what I thought, but you know, not at all what I thought I was going to see when I got to Palestine. I didn't think I was going to come to Palestine and necessarily sign somebody off the back of that one trip. But you know, I met somebody that you know, we really clicked, you know. And, you know, he's a really interesting artist because, you know, the way I see it is, you know, there is a lot of misunderstanding and misconception of what is going on in Palestine and or even what Palestinian people are, or you know what I mean, like it. I had an incredible time in Palestine. I'd say at least half of the people I was with were Europeans and Americans, and many of them were Jewish who had been to Israel but had never been to Palestine.
Wow.
And all of us, you know, 100% of the people that were there were all like, wow, this is not what I thought it was going to be, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a real eye-opening experience. And what I felt coming away from that was Bashar is like a great messenger for his cause, you know? He's talking about some real shit, you know? He's talking about the realities of living on the ground, you know, as a Palestinian,
yeah.
You know, just from his, you know, his observations of his frustrations and what his life is like. And I think the fact that he's able to do it in a way that really reflects who he is as a person and is not sort of stereotypical in any way,
right.
It makes him a great messenger for his cause, you know?
What is Bashar's last name?
It's Murad, Murad. So you'll find some videos, you'll see some music, you know, on the streaming platforms, and on, you'll see some of his videos on YouTube. The next single, Maskara, it's called, is coming out in a few weeks. It's not out yet, but... yeah, you'll have to look out for it.
Yeah, I am. I'm very, very excited. I mean, the video, you know, which I kind of had the preview to. Where is it shot? Is it shot in Ramallah? Where is it shot?
It's shot in Bethlehem. So Banksy has a hotel in Bethlehem called the Walled Off Hotel, and it's sort of. I've been there, and it's a really mad place. It's sort of like a museum of the occupation, you know, and it's right in front of, you know, what Palestinians call the apartheid wall. You know, it's just this massive wall that's, you know, separates them from the other side. And so over the years, it's been graffitied up, and there's, you know, graffiti of Trump and, you know, all kinds of slogans and really interesting Banksy style art all over it. And so they built this sort of hotel right in front of the wall. And when you get a t-shirt from the hotel that says, you know, the hotel with the worst view in the world, you know, cause it's literally just facing the wall. There's nothing else that you see, you know? That was the first time a music video is being shot in Banksy's hotel. So that was a cool thing to do.
That is so, Spec, I am just so excited listening to you about all these amazing artists and what they're doing and the kind of statements they're making. I always believe that art in any form, music, comedy, filmmaking, you know, it really kind of a lot of times just stops and makes people think about the things that they're doing and the action that they're taking. And, you know, I feel like in Bashar's case, he is talking about really the embracing of the LGBTQ community that is often silenced, you know, in Muslim communities and Muslim countries, period, not just Palestine, just across the board. And what a brave innovative and groundbreaking artist, and so incredibly courageous, you know, to stand up and to, is he out in, like, does everybody in his family and just, is he out? Is he like, yes, I'm openly gay, or is that not a thing that's talked about?
No, it's talked about. I mean, if you Google him, you'll see that there's been articles in the BBC and the Guardian and the Globe and Mail, you know, different newspapers and, you know, trades and stuff have written about him as, you know, because I think people were surprised that somebody like him existed, you know? So it's been written about, you know? My thing is that I think it's, you know, it's obvious, you know, who he is obviously a big part of the story, but at the end of the day, he's, I think, an incredible artist, you know? Like he directed that video. He's directed all his videos.
Oh my God!
He wrote 100% of that song, you know, which is not necessarily common these days. Most songs are written by 3 or 4 people these days. I mean, if you look at the pop charts, 5 or 6 people, you know. So somebody who wrote 100% of the song, music, lyrics, melody, you know, you name it, and they shot the video and stylized it and did everything. He's you know, you don't come across that every day, you know? And so for me, it's like, well, you know, he's an artist. He's meant to express himself however he can authentically based on his worldview. And that's where his value is, but he's an incredible artist, you know, at the end of the day. And that to me is sort of like the most important thing. And now our job is just to support him in being able to tell his story. And hopefully, you know, for me as an A&R or as the head of the label is to try and sort of give him the tools that he needs to make the best music that he can, you know, or create the best art that he can, you know, and hopefully it'll find an audience.
I mean, it's wonderful. I think what you're doing and what your label is doing is absolutely outstanding. I mean, the last time I was in Dubai headlining a show was about 3 years ago, so I'm definitely overdue.
If you come down, you gotta come check me. You know?
Oh yeah, I'm totally gonna stalk you, Spec. So just get ready. I'm gonna like totally stalk. I've never been to Abu Dhabi actually. I've been to Dubai a few times, but I've never been to Abu Dhabi. So I'm definitely gonna be there. So Spec, where can people kind of follow these incredible artists and their music? Like, where can they go check all this stuff out? I know I put up your website here, poparabia.com. Is there anywhere else that people can follow you? People can follow Poparabia?
Yeah, we've got the artists that you know, we're literally just start, you know, the signing regional artists is a fairly new you know, aspect of Poparabia's business. Historically, we were representing music publishers in the Middle East and licensing their music. We're now signing and developing regional talent with our partners at Reservoir. So on the Pop Arabia website, you'll see Bashar's name and links to his social media and the rest of it. And then you'll see another artist named Chris, who's a Lebanese soul singer, really. Their links and what they have is you know, you can get the links to their social media and the rest of it on popery.com.
Spike, this was really fantastic. Thank you for waking up at 7 a.m. to do this.
No worries. Only for you, Mona.
You're the best, Spike. You're the best. Thank you so much. I mean, I learned so much today about just about the music, just about what's happening and what you guys are doing in the Middle East. I mean, it really is outstanding what you guys are doing.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Yeah, thanks. You keep on doing what you're doing. You're part of the, you know, part of you're opening it up on the other end as well, which is awesome. You know.
Yeah, trying to start a revolution, Spike.
Yeah, one step at a time.
One step at a time, man. Spec, thank you so much for tuning in. I will definitely talk to you soon, but really great conversations. Thank you.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was the lovely and amazing Hussein Spec Yusuf, you guys. I had a fantastic conversation. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I definitely did. I will be back tomorrow with also a DJ in Dubai, one of the biggest DJs in Dubai, DJ Bliss. Marwan is his real name, but he goes by DJ Bliss. I had a fantastic time working with him about 3 years ago because he is the one who asked me to come out to Dubai and headline a show. So I'm finally getting an opportunity to bring him on and have a conversation. But you guys, thank you so much for tuning in. If you haven't followed me on YouTube yet, please do. You can. My link is below, Mona Shea Comedian. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Mona's Comedy. Thank you so much for tuning in late. I appreciate you. I will see you tomorrow, 6:15 Pacific. Have a good night.